Do you ever look at your kids and think, they've got it easy? Life was so much harder back in my day. Well, have I got the podcast for you. It's called Wait, They Did What? We take a trip back in time to when kids could buy fireworks, cars didn't have seatbelts, and we all had to sing God Save the Queen.
They did what?
They did what?
They did what?
I can't believe that.
Check it out with your kids. Wait, They Did What? Is on ABC Listen and ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today it's my conversation with author, broadcaster and comedian Sandy Toksvig. Sandy's best known in Australia as a host of the BBC series QI, but that is just the merest, teeniest, tiniest portion of a fabulous life spent in the relentless pursuit of everything that interests her. Sandy's curiosity was stoked from a young age by her dad, who was Denmark's first TV foreign correspondent. And that meant that Sandy grew up all over the world, in Europe and Africa and New York City. Despite being a frequent absentee student, Sandy went on to Cambridge University. And while she was there, she joined Footlights. And then she appeared on the very first night of London's legendary Comedy Store. Sandy Toksvig appeared regularly on shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Have I Got News For You? She's written more than 20 books for adults and for children. And as an 11-year-old, Sandy played a crucial role in NASA's mission control during the Apollo 11 moon landings. Hi, Sandy.
It's like my life flashed before me there, Richard. I feel there's nothing left to say. Really.
I don't. Let's wrap it up now, shall we? Let's go home and have a cup of tea or something. I mentioned your dad there, who was on the telly as well. Tell me a bit about the kind of man he was and what he meant to you.
Well, we just passed the anniversary of his passing, which is extraordinary to me because he was such a vibrant guy. The fact that he's not here is hard to believe. He passed away 34 years ago. He was, and not just because he was my dad, the sort of guy that lit up a room. He had a charm about him. He was the sort of man who couldn't go into a bar without buying a round of drinks for everybody. And he taught me to be interested in minutiae. He was a brilliant correspondent. And he always said it's the detail that is going to sell the story to the audience. I'll give you a very quick example. He was broadcasting to Denmark the marriage of Prince Charles and Princess Diana, and he was trying to find a Danish connection of any kind. And Kiri Takanova was singing, and he discovered that her earrings were made by a Danish jeweler. And he went, that's it. That's the one. There we go. His excitement at that, I've never forgotten him.
He must have been very well known in Denmark. What did that mean when you went out in public as a family?
Well, it gave me a very odd relationship with fame early in my life. I don't remember a time when my family wasn't in the spotlight. My dad was incredibly famous. When Danish television started, my dad was the very first host of the news. And in those days, it's hard to believe now, the news would come on. I don't know how old you are, Richard, but it used to be that if you wanted to watch television at 7, you had to turn on at 5:02 to warm the television up. You know, you had to have a little moment for it to think about going, oh, I get to broadcast now. The lights would come on at the back. So my dad came on at 7. He read the news from a desk in black and white. There were no insert film footages at all. He had a red telephone on his desk. I don't know why it was red, because it was black and white telly. And occasionally the Prime Minister would ring and they would do an interview together. And my dad would often smoke his pipe while reading the news. So this is how casual it was. At 8 o'clock, he would finish and then they would do a half-hour documentary about, I don't know, the Queen's silver spoon collection. And then the service would close down. My father was 2/3 of all available Danish television. He was famous in a way. That's it. We had one channel and he was an hour over an hour and a half. I don't think you can imagine fame like it.
You're saying to me that the TV station closed down at what, 8:30 or something, didn't it?
8:30, yes, it was an hour and a half.
That was it. That was thought to be quite enough television for the Danish public, was it, at that point?
Darling, there was milking to do in the morning. I'm not going to keep you up past half past 8. Ridiculous. So when we went out, if we went into a restaurant, this is how old-fashioned it is. You're talking about the early 1960s. The men in the restaurant who were dining, if my father walked in, would stand up and bow their heads and click their heels until he sat down to eat. It was weird. It was weird.
Did all that go to his head a bit, I wonder?
No, not in the slightest. So he was so wonderful about it. What he always taught me, and he had no idea what I was planning to do for a living, he said, the thing about fame, Sandy, is it doesn't mean anything. It's absolute nonsense unless you use it for good purpose. unless you try and make it mean something. So he was passionate about being factually accurate. He would be so horrified by the misinformation around things like, for example, American elections and so on, just to pick a subject at random. Mm. And he was passionate that he had to tell the truth and that the audience had to believe him, because he said, otherwise, I'm just a mouthpiece. And I remember on holiday, he once grew most exquisite, very neat, what we used to call a naval beard. He thought it was marvellous. He was very pleased with it. And he went on television with his neat naval beard, and he got lots of letters saying, what a marvellous beard. And he immediately shaved it off. And I said, why did you do that, Dag? It looked really nice. And he said, because if they're looking at my beard and talking about that, they're not listening to what I'm saying.
Oh,
so
that's lovely.
So it was important to him that he said the truth.
And is he still an influence on how you go about your day-to-day life today?
Absolutely. I think about him every time I take a seat in a television studio. Of course, I stood behind the cameras for years and watched him working. And I remember him saying to me, he came to visit me in my very first television show that I was doing. And I said at one point, I said, can I get a glass of water? And he took me to one side and he said, darling, you need to learn the name of the person whose job it is to get you the glass of water, because they're as important a member of the team as you are. So I don't want to ever hear you say again, may I have a glass of water? I want you to hear you say the name of the person and then ask them for the glass of water. And
that's
he was right.
That's a famous in Australia, right, a bit of advice that was given to a Prime Minister, Paul Keating, by his mentor, who said, watch how people in politics treat service people. Watch how a politician treats a waiter, a taxi driver, a cleaner, a flight attendant. That'll tell you so much about who they are and their personality. Yeah. This is the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. And when my father passed, which was, you know, horrendous time in my life, at his funeral, our local postman and the Prime Minister sat next to each other in the front row of the church. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, that's you got that right.
Your mum was British. How did she meet your dad?
So when Danish radio, as we still call it, we still call Danish television Danish radio, when Danish radio started, so it was their equivalent of the BBC, in order to do the trainings that hadn't happened before, they sent my dad as one of the first trainees to the BBC. And my mum, who doesn't ever get as much credit as my dad, and she should, she was one of the first female studio managers at the BBC. It was unheard of to have a woman in. Imagine a woman putting the news on. Extraordinary idea. And so she literally met him through the glass. People who are not familiar with radio studios won't know that the sort of controls are at the other side of a large piece of glass to the person who's broadcasting. And she put him on air. I don't know if the glass steamed up. I don't like to think about it too much, Richard. It's my parents. Do you know what I'm saying?
I was going to ask you if it was love at first sight, but it is your mum and dad. And you probably don't want to go there. No, that's right.
I don't. You know, they liked each other.
They liked each other. That's marvellous. And here you are in the world, and that's lovely.
I know.
You mentioned there that the TV had to go off at 8:30 so people could get up to do the milking. Was Denmark still quite a rural, provincial society? Did you have country, rural family members?
Yes, absolutely. I had a great aunt who was a milkmaid all her life. And she was the sweetest person I think I've ever met. And when she got married, she had a week's holiday in Copenhagen. And when she got back to the Jutland, the mainland, the main country area of Denmark, nobody wanted to know what Copenhagen was like. Everybody wanted to know what it was like to have a week off. It was just was unheard of. And she told me a story, and it has stayed with me all of my life. So they got every other Christmas off, right, the milkmaids. So one year, it was her year to have Christmas off. And a milkmaid came to her and said, could she swap years? Because there was a boy she really liked and she wanted to go to a dance with him. And my aunt said no, she wanted to have Christmas off. And she said she regretted it for the whole of her life.
Oh, she remembered that one unkindness, did she?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So there's an interesting lesson for us all there.
I have a very good friend who grew up in Iceland. His early years were in Iceland. And he said as he was growing up, there was a TV ad campaign in Reykjavik that said, Iceland, it's okay to smile, because they wanted to encourage Icelanders to smile for visitors. Because he said, until then, Icelanders saw smiling as a sign of weakness and laughter as a sign of madness. Was Denmark a fellow Scandi country a bit like that as well, Sandy?
Well, no. I mean, I went into comedy because of Denmark. So my dad had, as is the way, he had lots of friends in show business. And he had a friend of his called Dirk Passer. And Dirk Passer was, in his time, the most famous comic kind of slash clown in Denmark. And I remember going to see him at the age of 6 and watching him just have the audience completely in the palm of his hand. And people were rocking with laughter. And I sat there and I thought, yeah, that. I'd like to do what he's doing. That looks like fun. So the Danes have a great sense of humour, but they will also tell you straight out, if you say to them, what do you think of the thing I'm wearing? It doesn't suit you. And they're trying to be kind. They're trying to be kind. I don't think it's just a Danish thing. I think it's a Scandinavian thing. I was in Norway. We went to Norway to the Arctic for our honeymoon. And we were right up in the north in a place called the Lofoten Islands. And I was talking to this guy and I said, how bad does the weather get up here? He said, well, last winter, the porch blew off our house. And I said, oh, that's terrible. And he said, no, it was winter. Who needs a porch in the winter? And I thought, wow, yeah, that's such a Scandi attitude. Okay, we'll worry about that in the spring.
Norway, the home of disposable porches.
I know, right? You just imagine some porch flying past somebody go, oh, there's Olaf's porch again. I quite like it as an attitude. I think we all worry too much about stuff.
That's right. Let's not get so hung up on our porches. I quite agree. you've written about your family's extraordinary story during the Second World War and your father, who was a boy during that time. Tell me how you found out this story and how it unfolded as it was told to you.
My dad didn't really talk very much about it. So Denmark was occupied during the Second World War, Copenhagen in particular. And it used to make my dad very mad that in Britain, for example, they used to refer to Denmark, not everybody, some people referred to Denmark as Hitler's canary, and there was a suggestion that the Danes were colluding with the Germans being there, and it wasn't the case at all. And he eventually, although very slowly, told me the story of what happened. So I come from a long line of theatricals and writers, and my grandmother, my father's mother, was an actress. She was extremely beautiful. And my grandfather was a writer and a painter, a scenic artist. And when Germany occupied Denmark, we didn't have a large Jewish population, perhaps 7,000 or 8,000 people. It was decided by a number of right-thinking people that what they needed to do was to get the Jewish population out to Sweden. And the story is remarkable. So it was very dangerous. You have to imagine there was the SS troops everywhere, the German troops. My grandfather created and painted a false wall in their apartment in central Copenhagen. So it created a sort of a narrow space, maybe 3-4 feet deep. But if you looked at it, you put a chaise lounge right in front of it, almost to draw attention to it. If you looked at it as you walked into the room, you would think that was the end of the room. That is how he painted it. And then they hid a Jewish family behind this wall. And they did have a gun, but they hid it in a geranium flower pot. And my father, who was perhaps 11 at the time, ran messages for the underground. And then on one occasion they heard that the SS were going to come and search the apartment. So they put the Jewish family behind the wall. And my grandmother, bear in mind, actress, she lay on the chaise lounge, and before the soldiers arrived, she cut her legs all over with a sharp knife and then applied theatrical makeup so she looked like she had terrible sores on her legs. And then she covered herself with a shawl, and knowing my grandmother, probably cashmere. And my father, small boy, stood in front of the geranium pot, which had the gun hidden in it, on instructions that at the last minute, if there was nothing else to do, he was to reach for the gun. And the soldiers arrived, and my father said my grandmother gave the finest performance of her life. She threw back the shawl and said, how could you accuse a woman who's this ill of doing anything at all? Look at me, I can't walk, I can, you know. He said it was, you know, damo camellia. It was just amazing performance.
Did she disgust them? Is that part of the trick as well, disgusting them by her sores?
Yes, disgusting them, horrified that you could treat a woman like this, a mixture of trembling lip and outrage, tears, and they never did take the gun out of the geranium pot. The men went away, and that Jewish family was safely taken by small boat across the waters to Sweden. And years later, my uncle Hans, my father's brother, was getting married, and he went to a tailor to have a suit made. And the man said to him, it's almost making me cry as I say it to you. And the man said to him, I'm not going to charge you for this suit because I was the small boy who escaped that day from your home.
Oh, Sandy, that story makes me think and feel so many different things. How does it make you think and feel when you hear that?
Well, it's a lot to live up to have a family like that. And I remember saying to my dad, why did you do it? You weren't Jewish. You didn't even have any Jewish friends. And he just shrugged and said, it was the right thing to do. And that is like, if I had a motto in my life, it's that. Try and do the right thing. So I have a lot to You know, he was a great guy. It's, you know, maybe it would have been nice to have had a bricklayer dad. My English grandfather was a bricklayer, so I don't know why I picked that.
So when you were seven or so, the family moved to the United States. What brought you there?
So Denmark decided that it was time we had a foreign correspondent. It was a new idea. And so in order to have one, because that's all they could afford, they sent my dad to New York because the United Nations was there. There was a theory, which I like, that you could cover the whole world from the United Nations because it'd be somebody from that country that you could talk to. And so we moved there. People don't know how the information dissemination has changed. My dad used to go out with a film crew and he would shoot a story about whatever it was. And then quite often late at night, my dad and I would drive out to Kennedy Airport, the main airport in New York, with a large roll of film in a silver canister. And we would go up to people flying to Copenhagen and ask them if they'd take the news home.
And what? Really?
It seems, yeah. And then you'd meet some nice person, and my dad would probably know somebody who was at school with or something. Denmark's quite a small country. And they would take the film home. So a story would take maybe 3 days from shooting to appearing on the television. And nobody was in a great hurry. Nobody was racing to get the news. It wasn't like last minute, oh, this has happened and that's happened. And my dad always referred to it as edited reality, that he wanted in his, whatever the broadcast was going to be, 3 minutes or whatever, to make sure that it was the truth about what he had done. It just took a bit longer. It was a little bit more thoughtful. And I think that's probably not a bad thing.
Do you remember how you responded to moving from Copenhagen, which is beautiful and very human in scale, to the great roaring enormity of Manhattan?
I loved it. I'm still excited when I arrive anywhere. I have a real sense of the potential of anywhere new. And what I learned from my dad is that everywhere in the world has something to commend it. You just need to go and find it. So all I see is possibility when I go anywhere. And I think I felt that when we arrived in New York, just the smell of it and the steam rising up from the subway in the street. And there's something magical. Still, I feel that. I feel very at home in New York. But it has left me with a great love of arriving anywhere new.
How did your father encourage you to become interested, you and your brother, to become interested in current affairs, worldliness, the world at large?
Well, I don't think we had any choice, Richard. So
really?
Again, I must sound like some terrible dinosaur. So in our house, we had a Reuters ticker tape machine. Reuters is still one of the great news services. And a ticker tape machine was a machine that sort of fed the news out, and it didn't stop. It just kept sort of coming.
So you had this chattering machine in the apartment.
This chattering machine was in my dad's study. And it would ping. It would ping one for, quite interesting, two for, and three for invasion, pretty much. That was kind of, So I have never forgotten the night when Russia invaded Czechoslovakia because it just kept pinging threes all the time. So there was a sense of the news being a backdrop to our lives. There was a sense of the soundtrack of a ticker tape machine constantly telling us that something was happening. Plus, Dad never treated us like children. He just thought we were sort of slightly smaller adults. I don't ever remember him talking to us as a child. From about the age of eight, me and my brother read the first three pages of the New York Times before supper so that we had something interesting to talk about because, dear God, he didn't want to hear about school. I guess we were expected to be up to speed. And we attended lots of events. I went to both the Republican and the Democrat national conventions. We attended all kinds of things. We were endlessly on the road, but we were aware of what was happening. One of the most distressing moments of my life, my father ringing in tears because he had been there when Robert Kennedy was shot, and him ringing saying, this is so horrific for America, and this is, not wearing his impartial journalist's hat, but he had personally liked Robert Kennedy and spent time with him. So there were things that really stay with me, that my father's reaction to it and the importance on the world stage of it absolutely was brought home to me. And my brother is now an absolutely brilliant foreign journalist. He's on the editorial side, but is an extraordinary journalist. So it stayed with us. I don't think it has ever left either of us.
So that was 68, and 69 was the year of the Apollo moon landing. Tell me about the day your dad took you to Cape Kennedy for the launch of the Apollo moon mission in 69. How close did you get to the rocket, Sandy?
Well, incredibly close. So again, I'm 11 years old, and I'm thinking, oh, Florida fun, because in those days you could get a baby alligator for hardly any money at the roadside. And they were like $10 or something. I thought, wow, let's get a baby alligator. And we drove down. There's a place called, there's a road called the Beeline Highway. And it was just exciting. I thought, oh, go to Florida. How marvelous. And then there was less anxiety about childcare, can I just say, in those days. I think there was a lot less anxiety. So my mum went off to help Dad because there were these huge booths set up for all the foreign journalists. So Apollo 11, of course, anybody who doesn't recall the very first manned mission to the moon. So my brother and I were sort of abandoned at a beach, which was all the families of the correspondents. And we were as close as you were allowed to be to the rocket, which is a mile and a half. But you could see it really clearly across the sort of flat waters. And when it, and there was the countdown, they had a big tannoy system set up. So you heard the countdown, T-minus 10. And there was all the stuff going on and people were very excited. And when it took off, the ground shook. I have such a strong recollection of it. And then we transferred. So that was Cape Kennedy, as was in Florida. And then we flew to Houston in Texas, which is where Mission Control was. And again, Dad was very busy and people didn't have the security they have now. I just say ABC, very hard to get into. In those days, Mission Control, Houston. I had some trouble getting to meet you, Richard. It was tricky. We arrived there and we just, my brother and I just wandered around. And my dad, I think I had persuaded him, had bought me a huge Texas cowboy hat, massive 10-gallon hat. And I was a tiny little thing. So I'm walking around with this big hat on. And then there's the moment Neil Armstrong's about to step out onto the moon and slightly flub his lines. And I'm standing there, there's a woman standing next to me. And I must have looked very curious, this massive hat on. I said to her, "Are you all right?" She said, "I'm a little nervous." I said, "Oh, why?" She said, "My boss is about to step out onto the moon." And it was Neil Armstrong's secretary. So I said, as you would as an 11-year-old, I said, "Oh, don't worry, I'll hold your hand." So when he stepped out onto the moon, I was holding Neil Armstrong's secretary's hand. I don't know whether she remembered it as well as I did, but it was an extraordinary thing.
I'm sure
she
remembered.
So I told my dad afterwards and he went, "Oh, I can't believe I didn't have a camera on that."
I'm sure she remembers the girl in the 10-gallon hat, the little girl holding her hand. So what were you like as a school kid once you were at school going back and forth, Sandy?
Oh, I don't know. Mouthy, I think, probably.
Mouthy?
I liked facts to be correct. I remember I had a teacher in the fifth grade in the United States. She was from Arkansas, and she was called Miss Strange. It's a great name, isn't it? Miss Strange. And she said, "The thing about Africa, children, is very hot. It's hot all the time." And I said, "Excuse me, Mount Kilimanjaro's got snow on it." "You're a liar, Sandy. You're just a liar. There is no snow in Africa." And I just thought, oh, my God. So I think I was probably, I must be very annoying. I'm sure Miss Strange went home and thought I was a nightmare.
I'm thinking, I've got the mental picture in my head now, the famous picture of Mount Kilimanjaro, and it's always snow-capped.
Thank you. I rest my case. Thank you very much.
So this is why you were absentee so often?
I found school a bit boring. We were given Catcher in the Rye to read, which is a slim book, frankly, by J.D. Salinger. So I went home and I read it, fully prepared to discuss it the next day. Had a discussion with my dad about it in the morning. I went in and realized they were going to read it one word at a time all year. So I thought, you know, I'll come back when they finished. I'll go find something else to do.
And what was that?
It makes sound like a smart ass. It makes me sound like a smart ass, which is not nice. I should have just sat there and done what they said, but I've always been impatient. I was impatient with the rest of them to read the book.
So where did you go if you weren't at school while they were plodding through Catcher in the Rye, page by page?
So I used to hang out at the local theatre. I used to hang out backstage. Sometimes I, ashamed to say, I took the train up to the city. We were in a suburb called Mamaroneck, which is a suburb of New York City, and I would take the train up and sneak into a matinee. That's terrible. It's terrible. If my children did this, I'd have to sit them down and say, "Well, I'm very disappointed," which is my go-to word with my children. So I'm not proud of it, Richard. I'm not proud. It's not good.
So what happened when your parents went to one of those parent-teacher nights at one of these schools you were supposed to be attending?
Well, fortunately, my parents had a very lackadaisical, mildly indolent attitude to parenting. So mostly they didn't go or ask me what I'd been up to. On one occasion, for reasons I can't recall, maybe there were free drinks. I don't know what happened. They went to a parent-teacher association meeting, couldn't find a teacher who knew me. So the game was up. Apparently it was not enough to just turn up every day and hang out at the local theatre. And so slightly despairing, because I was 14 by then, they sent me inexplicably to boarding school in England. My mother's from England. My grandparents were still alive then, living in England. And I think my English grandmother had a say in this because I went to the school that her best friend's kids had gone to. I say school. I'm going to say slash jail.
Hmm. I was going to say, for someone who's been a pretty free-range kid, I just felt my heart sinking then when you told me you were sent to a boarding school in the UK, Sandy.
It was hideous. I have a theory about British boarding schools. I don't know if it's the same in Australia. I think they are funded by therapists to breed new clients. I think that's the main purpose of boarding schools. It's a patient factory for therapists. I say this, I'm married to a therapist, so I have some understanding of how important this is. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful.
So who was there to greet you on your first day at boarding school in England?
So matron. Matron was a large woman. She wobbled. She didn't really walk. She wobbled. And she opened the door. I was very friendly. I had a big New York accent. I've been living in New York for years and years. I said, "Hi, I'm Sandy." And she said, "I'm matron." I said, "Oh, what is that, like your first name, your last name? How's that work there?" Anyway, she hated me on sight. So that was good. She made the next 4 years of my life hell. And because I had a thick New York accent, this is my sub story, Richard. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm bracing myself.
I'm totally over it. Little violin, if you wouldn't mind. For the first 6 weeks living in the UK, bear in mind I'd never lived in the UK, nobody spoke to me. So the whole school sent me to Coventry.
For how long did you say 6 weeks?
For the first 6 weeks of living there.
And was that your accent?
Yeah.
And how did you change your accent? Because you're not using a New York accent anymore.
I know. As I speak, like I'm trapped in a black and white film. And that is because I am trapped in a black and white film. I, very occasionally, we weren't allowed to watch television because it was too exciting for the girls. Occasionally, we were shown a film and we were one night shown Brief Encounter. I don't know why. It's quite a sexually charged film.
Yeah.
Celia Johnson and Trevor Howard. And I watched the film and I thought, oh, well, whatever. I'll speak like that. So I speak like Celia Johnson in Brief Encounter. However, if and when, Richard, you and I enjoy a small schooner of beer, I will revert to my real accent, which is somewhere, I think, between the Norwegian porch guy and American.
Do you need to have a drink for that to come out?
I think it's probably best. Best to keep it quiet.
Now, Sandy, once the dreadful business of school was over for you, you went to Cambridge to study law and anthropology and archaeology. Did university suit you much better than school? I'm guessing that it did.
Initially, I found it hugely exciting because the presence of clever people is always energizing, I think. It was, again, it's hard to imagine, but it was the late 70s. It was still a huge imbalance in terms of gender. So there were 10 boys for every girl on my course. And if you wanted to get heard, you really needed to make yourself unpopular, I think, because it was hard for women to get in. I loved the study of law. I really enjoyed it. I had my dream then was to become a human rights lawyer. And gradually, through my training, I began to realize more and more that the legal system, maybe it's not true in Australia, but certainly it's true in Britain, was more and more about money and less about justice. And that's not true for everybody, but it was certainly true for the kind of course that I was on. So I started taking random courses that nobody else was interested in. I took, I was one of only three people, all women, who took the very first course taught on Muslim law in the United Kingdom. And I found that fascinating because I love knowledge just for its own sake. So I'm possibly a rare atheist who's read the whole of the Quran and found it interesting. And I loved all of that side of it. And then, very sadly, between my second and my third year, I became extremely ill and had to have a life-saving operation.
How did you notice something was wrong? What were the signs that something has gone badly wrong?
Well, I didn't. I have a terrible disconnect, I think, between my brain and my body. I sort of pay very little scant attention
to your body.
And I had lost an enormous amount of weight and had gone down to 5.5 stone. I don't know what that is in real
life.
Oh,
dear. Oh, dear. That's not good.
That's 5 times 14, 76 pounds. That's not very, not a lot.
I only know what it is in the old money, too, so that's okay. That's fine.
That's thin.
Yes, you're
real thin.
Very, too thin.
Let's go with real thin. Mm. Cartoon-like thin, but with quite a large belly. And my English grandmother, who was mostly not a terribly nice person, said to me, "Are you pregnant?" And I said, "No, Granny." "Then I think you're ill." And I went to the doctors, and indeed I was extremely unwell and had an operation. And so I was advised not to go back for my third year, but
I have to ask, what was wrong? What did they find?
Oh, darling, I was written up in The Lancet, which is a medical magazine. I had the largest ovarian cyst ever seen. And the real issue was not the cyst itself, but the fact that it was crushing all my organs. They had never seen something like it. In order I think they had to wear Wellingtons during the operation. I think there was an awful lot of liquid. But I have a scar about 11 inches across my whole system because they couldn't get to it.
Oh, my God, Sandy, that's extraordinary.
I know, it's weird, right? Why not? Why have something dull? Why not have something interesting?
Typical attention seeker you are appearing in The Lancet, too. It's like, look at me all the time, isn't it? Look at that.
Look at this thing.
Look at this thing. Seriously, though, I suppose you don't know how bad you're feeling until you have your giant ovarian cyst cut out of you. What was it like to then recover? Did it take forever to recover, or did you recover quite quickly?
No, it took a very long time, and the scar was very large. I had lost a ridiculous amount of weight. I was very poorly, very weak.
Did you think you were going to die?
I did, because they didn't know what it was. I had one of the world's first ultrasounds, and they thought it was a tumour. So it was not a happy time. But my dad, bless his heart, he used to come. He was very excited. I remember that he had just found, do you remember portable radios? He had just found the world's first portable tiny television, black and white television, and he used to come and watch the cricket on a screen that was about 2 inches square. I don't think he could see the ball, but I remember him sitting by my hospital bed just holding my hand, and we didn't really chat because I was too weak, but it was nice that he sat there with me. He was very excited by this new piece of technology. I often think how excited he'd be by all the stuff now. It would be so amazing.
Does the wound still trouble you? Does that hideous experience still cause you physical pain? Or?
Well, the scar is very helpful. It tells me when the weather's going to change. So I get a twinge.
Are you serious?
I took a twinge in my scar.
I never know what to make when people tell me this. I had a brother-in-law who said, could absolutely tell when it was going to rain, but he said, I've been sniffing up the chimney. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, and he was right. Are you serious? You can tell when the weather's going to change?
I can. And as I get older, I had my first tattoo at 60, and I'm 64 now. I was thinking, because it's a straight line across my stomach, I was thinking of having a small zip tattooed on one end of it. Just like. Hey, help yourself, open up.
I think you could do a really interesting sort of like bizarre meteorology section at the end of the news, and I think you'd be following in your dad's footsteps, and I think it'd be a marvellous thing all around.
Yes. And we go over to Sandy's scar. Oh, right. It's going to rain, everybody.
And you could say, yeah, don't listen to what that fool just told you. I'm telling you, it's going to rain. Yes, that'd be marvellous. Tremendous. My God. Anyway, was this the same year you fell in love for the first time?
Yes, no. So I fell in love in my first year at university with the third year, which was, shocking. It's only 2 years apart, but when you're a first year, you just think, oh, third year, so amazing.
And how did you fall in love?
Well, she lived in the room above mine in our halls, and she came down to complain about the noise I was making.
And she never quite left?
I was laughing and laughing. And she came down and stayed.
Oh, how nice. What was that like to have all that sort of revealed to you all the time? First of all, love and your sexuality and all those sorts of things sort of hitting you in that flood tide of youth and being at Cambridge and all of that, Sandy.
Well, it should have been wonderful and it should have been amazing. But again, we're talking about the late 70s. We didn't know anybody else. We didn't know, there was no, I don't know what you call it, a gay society, gay sock, we used to say. There's no such thing. Well, there was maybe, but we didn't know about it. We didn't know anybody else. It was a secret. We couldn't tell our friends. We couldn't tell the family. So that moment when you fall in love, which should be so thrilling and exciting, I was 19, was marred by the secrecy. I'm so proud of young people now being who they want to be. I'm so proud of the new language. I'm so proud of what they're all doing. Because to go back to those horrible, dark, shadowed days would be horrific and is positively dangerous for people's mental health.
It was all terribly cruel. How did the college react when they discovered that you were sharing a bed with another lady person?
Well, it's so ridiculous because the college I was at, Girton College, was founded, as far as I can work out, by a lesbian couple, but everybody seemed to have forgotten that. But anyway, so she came up to see me. She had graduated, but when I was very ill, she came up one weekend to look after me. I was really still very weak and very unwell. And she came up to look after me, and they found out and decided that they would discuss at board level whether I should be, what Cambridge called, be sent down, be thrown out. Even though there were girls up and down the corridor who had boys living full time, but that was fine. We were fine with that. And she'd only come up for the weekend to check on me. Anyway, after 3 weeks' discussion, I don't know. I can't imagine what the discussion was like. They decided I could stay because of my excellent academic record. So, lesson to you all, people, be gay, but be clever about it.
So and it was then, the old don't frighten the horses thing. Was that the
honestly,
idea?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, again, for the second time in my life, people didn't speak to me. I was sent to Coventry by the people at the college. And I think there's something in me that I think they wanted me to leave because it was so uncomfortable. I think what they were trying to do was to get me to go because it was so awful. And don't do that to me because that will just make me stay. But my best friend at the time at the university, still my friend, Helen Gavin, amazing, amazing woman. Helen is a very passionate Catholic, goes to Mass, I think every day, but I mean a lot. Like a lot, it takes up a lot of time. And she just carried on the same. She's carried on speaking to me. She just carried on being my friend, carried on having coffee with me. She was the only person who would eat lunch with me. She just sat with me the whole time. And I said, why are you doing this? Surely the Pope would think that I'm a very bad person. And all she ever said about it was, I think the Pope may have got this one wrong. And I love her to this day. She's a passionate, loyal human being. Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous person. And years later, she brokered a deal. She spoke to the college and said, what happened to Sandy is a disgrace, and it has stayed with me. And maybe 3-4 years ago, we went up to the college. They made me a fellow. They apologized publicly. And we had the college's first ever LGBTQ+ dinner in the hall with 450 students who identified as queer and rainbow flags flying. And it was great. It was great. And she did that. She made that happen.
But at the time, experiencing all that awful disdain and the alienation that must come with that, this is around the same time you're doing Footlights, doing improv,
yes,
and then doing comedy for the first time. I just wonder about your irreducible. Is there some kind of invincible core about you that knows that you can win people over or something? Is that what it is, Sandy?
Well, of course, I don't know a single comedian that doesn't sit crying in the dressing room and go, I'm trying to make the world a better place. My life's terrible. Most comedians have a fairly dark streak in them. But, of course, comedy is a great way to try and see the world in a slightly better light.
I mean, you, though. I mean, to take that step out of the alienation and onto the stage where you make people laugh. I'm going to just Miriam Margolyes did the same thing a generation before you as well.
Yeah.
That speaks of something unconquerable there, I think. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes it's so painful that you just literally feel like you can't bear it. And so the only thing to do is to try and turn a spotlight on it and make it funny. I think it's so painful that you can succumb, which very sadly some people do, and they never fully recover. Their mental health doesn't recover. Too many LGBTQ+ people have been lost to suicide. It's a very high percentage because of the way in which they've been treated. And I hope if just one person looks at me and goes, okay, let's keep going, then I feel like I didn't become a human rights lawyer, but I did something.
I read that you performed on the very first night of the Comedy Store. Was that before it went to Leicester Square when it was still in Soho back in those days? Alexi Sale was hosting and all that. Was that that night?
Yes. It seems extraordinary. They came up to Cambridge to look for people. And I was at the time doing a very strange double act with a guy called Simon McBurney. And Simon has gone on to run the most astonishing theatre company called Theatre de Complicité. And Simon was at the time going out with the girl called Emma Thompson. I don't know what happened to her. And so they asked me and Simon to come down to the Comedy Store. And it wasn't a real comedy club. There were no stand-up comedy clubs. It was absolutely unheard of. So what they'd done is they'd taken a Sunday night at a strip joint. And I remember it was going into the bar area, and it was called the Doubles Bar. And the woman behind the bar was very cross because she'd been made to wear a top for the evening, which she didn't normally. And I was, you know, 19, 20 years old. I was, what? I don't know what was happening. I think Alexi was hosting that night, and Simon and I went on and did the thing. Anyway, they have a list in the current incarnation of the Comedy Store. They have the playlist from that night of all the people who performed. And for me, it says Simon McBurney and Sandy with a Y, which is not how you spell my name, and no surname. It looks like he came on with his dog. It's like the most, I just think, wow, that's how I'm going to be remembered. Simon McBurney's dog. And Emma Thompson did sound effects for us. I think it was her finest moment in show business.
When you say sound effects, do you mean like with like a cowbell, or was she making vocal sound effects?
We had one of those football rattles for reasons I can't recall, for used for comedic effect.
So then you're on television all the time. You're doing Have I Got News for You and Whose Line Is It Anyway? And you're quite a well-known figure. In 1994, you and your partner at the time had a young family, and then you heard the Daily Mail was going to have a crack at you. How did you find out about that?
I don't know if you know the Daily Mail here. But
oh yeah, oh yeah.
Don't. Yes. Don't. I'm just going to say don't. By then I had three small children, and I just decided to out myself rather than let the Daily Mail do it. And we went and did an interview with the Sunday Times. And as far as I am aware, there was no other out woman in entertainment in 1994. I mean, you mentioned Miriam Ugly's Miriam didn't come out till many years later.
So you spoiled it. You spoiled the Daily Mail's headline.
I spoiled their story.
So it was mainly, it was you then. That was it. You were the only out gay woman in public life in the UK at that time.
Yeah, and then immediately the death threats start, you know. It's sad, isn't it? They all come from evangelical Christians, I'm afraid, without exception. They were going to kill me on God's behalf because apparently God's incredibly busy and didn't have time to do it himself. So we had to take the children to hiding. We had to have police protection. And at the same time, it looked as though my career was going to collapse, which I was fine. Actually, to be honest, I was fine with, because much better to have your children grow up proud of who they are than to have any kind of career in show business. It really wasn't a battle for me. It sounds like I was brave and thought, yeah, they'd give up my career, but actually it was no choice for me. My children have always come first.
How do they remember that now that they've grown up, that incident and that time? What do they tell you about that?
They're so wonderful. They're grown up and they're so proud. And I remember when my oldest daughter went to university and she got flu, and both me and her other mum raced up to look after her. And we were in her rooms, and one of us was plumping up her pillows and one of us was making soup. And one of her friends walked in and went, "Oh my God, two mums, not fair."
Ah, right.
So, yeah, you get double mummied if you're with us.
you mentioned there a career. Have you ever seen yourself as having a career? Because I noticed, like, I mean, I feel I could just as likely be talking to you as someone who's just emerged out of some pit in Jordan, having pulled out some ancient urn from Asia Minor or something or something like that. Had you pursued archaeology? It seems like you're a serial enthusiast for the things that you love and are interesting to you. Was that right, Sandy?
I think the world is fascinating, Richard. I never cease to be amazed. There's literally something every single day that I'm fascinated by. I'm always learning. I'm always going, oh, look at that. We've just arrived in Melbourne. I've never been here before. And I'm like a child in the taxi going, what's that? And what's that over there? And I love it. I'm as happy in a new city, sitting in a cafe, just watching the world go by, talking to anybody who will talk to me. I don't understand getting bored, really, other than reading Catcher in the Rye one word at a time. I think there's so much out there that I don't know. The older I get and the more time I spend on shows like QI, which are, you know, ostensibly all about knowledge, the more I realise how little I actually know. And that's a wonderful position to be in, because it makes you hungry to try and learn the next thing. So at the moment, I'm reading endlessly about trees and about woodland. It's become a new passion of mine. I'm going to learn to do metal detecting. There's just a million things that I want to do. So again, if my career stops tomorrow, then, you know, who knows what the Daily Mail have got? I don't know what they've got. If my career stops tomorrow, I'm fine with that, because I'll just go off and do something else.
Has that been a shield against depression?
Sure, of course. I am not immune. You know, nobody is. Nobody's immune to when the world treats you badly, you feel horrible. And to have to stand up constantly and say, well, I'm still going to be me, guys. You can't, you know, nothing must irritate the Daily Mail more than the fact that I'm still working, still laughing, still having a go at them. Must be very annoying. So, of course, you have moments when you have your dark days, and that's what you have your family for. And your dog, You have your dog to sit with.
What I mean is, can you use your curiosity to shrug it off?
To shrug it off? No, it sits with you. It sits with you. Of course it does. It is like a scar. It's like another scar in you. But what I think now of all the things I've been through, I like to think it's made me a nicer person. I like to think I have more empathy, that I'm a kinder person, that I understand a bit more about difference and what that feels like, which, you know, I might not have done had I not been through the things I've been through. So take the scars, but use them for a good purpose.
I love you as a host of QI. I think you're wonderful in that role.
Thank you.
I really do. And you look very, very comfortable in that role. You're sort of both ringmaster and provocateur. I like how you do both those things. You sort of keep the show on the road and sort of keep it moving along, but then you also kind of give it a bit of a whack around the head every once in a while. You seem to know exactly what the right moment to do that in, Sandy.
Well, you say I sit in comfortably, so here's the joke of it. The first, because I took over from Stephen Fry, who's absurdly tall, and I'm absurdly small. And for the first 2 years, they wouldn't give me my own chair. So I sat in Stephen's chair for 2 years with my legs dangling. And in the end, I said to them, guys, I'm not doing it again unless I can get my own chair. It's enough now with Stephen's chair. Please, could I have... So now I have my own chair, and it's adjustable, and I spend time racing around out of camera shot on my chair. It's got wheels, and it makes me very happy. It's ridiculous. My sign of success is that I've got my own chair.
What a pleasure it's been speaking with you, Sandy. I've so enjoyed this conversation with you, and thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I spoke to Sandy Toksvig in 2022 on her Australian tour. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country, produced by Alice Moldovan, and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.